This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1, the sound alternative. My name is Ramon Granfell, and joining me in the studio is Martin Alexander Wisson. How's it going, Marty?
Very well, thanks, Raymond. Yeah, pleased to be with you and the listeners, as always.
Once again, before we go any further, of course, massive love and respect to Mr. Jeff Bullen, the man with the golden tonsils. He'll be back next week.
Oh, I like that. The man with the golden tonsils. I wonder how many people even know that reference. But you're a thousand times better man than John Laws. I don't even consider John Laws a man, really. So there you are. Yeah. A thousand times better, Jeff.
A thousand times better than John Laws. He can put that on his resume. But no, he's back next Monday at 9 a.m. But of course, you can catch On The Record every weekday here at 9 a.m. on RTRFM. As I said, this is the Indie Media Show, a jam-packed show, back with, you know, the Alex and Ray show. It's always a jam flavour. What our flavour are we doing this week?
We're going with raspberry. Yeah, something raspberry, a little bit sweet, a yeah. little bit sort of, I was going to say spicy, not red, yeah, but yeah, sweet.
Raspberry
and kind of, no, it's not really spicy, is it? Anyway, sweet and lovely.
Yep.
I mean, those are the two words that come to mind when people think of Ramon Granfell and Alex Wisson, sweet and lovely.
And unfortunately, though, sweet and lovely, not a lot of that on the programme today. We're going to be talking about some quite... heinous, I guess, issues of the day. We're going to be, talking in a little while about the Land Forces Convention that's happening in Melbourne. What really, you know, could be summarized as a convention of war and death. It's where all the major weapons companies, their suppliers, manufacturers meet, and they basically, you know, try and, you know, get a whole bunch of government contracts and spruik their wares. The Australian government, of course, will be there trying to you know, extend contracts, renew contracts, and so forth. And it really, it's a non-controversial sort of issue to be opposed to something like this, despite whether you consider yourself on the left or the right or a centrist, aka someone who just doesn't care about anything. Effectively, this is a conference of war and death. But thankfully, there is a massive mobilization plan, and we're going to be talking to one of the organizers a little later about that, Natalie, about the convention and about the Disrupt Land Forces demonstrations that are planned kicking off this Sunday.
And regardless of your particular position on what's happening inside the CFMU, where there are, you know, problems and issues to sort out, the general concern that any person with of a liberal conscience of mind, let alone respect and understanding of the rule of law, would agree with is that the legislation passed by the federal Albanese Labor government is an absolutely grave assault on democracy, both within trade unions and potentially any membership-based organisation, that with the legislation passed by the federal parliament late last month, it sets a precedent now that is codified and ensconced in law, that the government can basically attack any democratic organisation that it likes, starting with the CFMEU, an easy target, the militant edge of the union. 11 trade union officials sacked, hundreds of delegates also removed their positions, administrator placed that can change the rules of the union and is basically going to govern the union undemocratically for 3 years. It's a disgraceful attack on democratic principles and on the rights and freedoms of trade unionists to organise in this country, starting with that leading edge of the CFMU. And the CFMU came out in public in strength and in numbers to defy that legislation and the appointment of an administrator last Tuesday. So we're going to bring you some highlights from that rally a little later on in the show.
But first up, we're going to get stuck right into it because, as I said, it's a jam-packed show. We're going to be looking now at an issue that's happening in Melbourne. In Melbourne, refugees have been camping outside first the Home Affairs Department in Melbourne, and then they moved to Docklands for now some 52 days, I believe. And these refugees are demanding permanent visas. The federal Labor government has left roughly 12,000 refugees in the limbo, many of them on temporary protection visas or a variation of, and most of those participating in the encampment arrived in Australia by boat before 2013 and have therefore been through a combination of offshore detention, onshore detention, and years living on these six-month bridging visas. It's really, you know, quite a dire situation for many of the people that are involved and on temporary visas. And quite tragically, you may have seen in the news last week, a young Tamil man self-immolated and took his own life just due to the frustration of the situation. He was actually someone who was involved in the encampment, and yeah, incredibly tragic news. But unfortunately, also, he is not alone. There has been multiple, as you'll hear in this upcoming interview, there has been multiple incidents where people have self-harmed or taken their own life from this refugee community. But to find out more about the encampment and why refugees are protesting there in Melbourne and is spreading elsewhere around the country, I had the opportunity to speak to Prasant. Prasant is an organiser with the refugee encampment in Melbourne. And I started out by just asking him why the encampment kicked off in the first place.
So my name is Prasant Kumaro, and I'm working as a nurse, and I live in Australia almost 12 years. So this encampment started with gay people in Oakley, on Cleonel's office, outside Cleonel's office. When there is a visa for in the ALP, then we move to Home Office Department in Docklands. So it's today is 50 days. So it's almost 50 days. We are camping outside Home Office. The demand is very simple for our permanent residency. So, yes.
Yeah, and I guess many of our listeners are probably, you know, quite familiar with, you know, the situation of many refugees in Australia. But however, I guess when, a lot of the camps closed down here in Australia, and unfortunately, you know, when things were pushed offshore, people perhaps, it's been out of a lot of people's minds unless they're directly dealing with it. But can you talk us through this, you know, being on a temporary protection visa or being on, you know, one of these visas? What is it like for people? What conditions do they have? What rights do they have? And obviously, yeah, people want permanent protection and something with a lot more security. But what's the current, situation for people?
When Labor government comes to the power, Labor government say there is no more refugees going to left over, left behind. So it's like 14,000 people get permanent residency, as everybody knows, and the 12,000 being left behind. For now, it's not the 12,000, it's only 8,500 or more maybe left. And the rest being deported or the rest being voluntary go back to the countries. And also, the visa conditions we have now is like a temporary bridging visa. And most of the people have the bridging visa, don't have the work rights and study rights and Medicare, like the basic, we don't have any basic human rights. And with the study rights, you can consider a student from grade 1 to 12 as domestic student. When the student go to university, they've been considered as an international student. So these are the issues. And also with the work rights, people being who always case being rejected by the fast track process called IAA, an unfair process. So most of the people who have here no work rights, no study rights. So you have to apply to the minister every 3 or 6 months to get your work rights and study rights back. If the minister is refused, then you don't have any work rights or study rights. So so we are really in a critical situation. Honestly, the 5 years and 3 years visa is meant to be given to the people who live in Australia in a long period of time. So I think we are already living 12 years, so we should get those 5 years or 3 years visa. Then we have to go to the pathway. the whoever's get the 5 years and 3 years visa 2 years earlier, they should get permanent residency straight away. So, you know, that's like, yeah. And also, so I just want to mention one more thing. We've been losing a lot of lives in our community. So, example, like the Tamil community, we've been losing almost 3 people, and one of my dear friend, my dear comrade, been kill himself.
Mm. I was going to mention that, and it is so incredibly tragic and horrible. Manoyogalinam, who I imagine you're referring to, self-immolated and passed away last week. Absolutely horrible and horrific. I guess, you know, it must be so hard for people in the community, first of all, to be experiencing all the stresses you're talking about of being on these temporary visas, but then to, you know, to have this kind of trauma as well, but also just to be organizing and trying to, you know, fight for your rights. I guess, you know, how has the community responded to this tragedy? And you know, obviously it's had a huge impact, but from what you're saying there, it's not an isolated incident, that there is a lot of people really struggling, and, you know, there could be more, and, you know, as horrible as it is to say, that there could be more people perhaps that are feeling like they have nothing else that they can do, as obviously, you know, the tragic incident of Manu.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm sorry. After Manu's incident, more people being aware how we going through, like, so every single person who's seeking asylum in Australia going through the same mindset as Manu. So Australia is a golden prison for us. So all of us being mentally tortured by this Australian government and their laws. So it's, I hope it will end up with this few people. I don't want any more from any refugee communities. So the only thing is, it's very simple thing to do. Like, you know, even if the government can't give us permanent residency straight away, but you know, the Biola family or the Ballarat family get the different visa category, like instead of the permanent residency straight away. So why can't they just give a different subclass or introduce a new subclass visa to make a pathway to the permanent residency? So we're just asking the government politely, please do something. We don't have nothing to lose anymore. We lose everything. We lose our dear friends. We don't want any more deaths be happening in our community.
Prasanth, look, you know, so much and love and solidarity to yourself and everyone involved. I guess, unfortunately, the history here in Australia is dealing with this incredibly restrictive and racist immigration system. But, you know, perhaps to end on, you know, more of a positive note, it seems as though you've received quite a lot of solidarity and, you know, people coming down to support the camp down there. Can you tell us a little bit about that in terms of the broader community and, you know, the people that have been trying to do their best to sort of, you know, to help you guys get the rights you deserve?
Thank you. So, as I said, we stopped with 3 people in Melbourne, the 24/7 encampment, and it's been built up. And we come to Docklands, there is a lot of socialist people. Example, I can give like a lot of organizations, WAG, or Radical Women, or Victorian Socialist Alternatives, and whoever support the refugees, the supporters of refugees, and the Palestinians supporters. They play a lead role in refugee encampment. So, and a lot of unions, United Australian Workers Union, and a lot of unions. So these, like, we get a lot of community support. So we feel so touched, and we feel very grateful. Please, those communities see us as a fellow human beings. This is what we want to see from the Australian government as well. we want the Australian government see us as a human beings. Don't see us as a case numbers. We are people who pay taxes, who are the loyal citizens to Australia. So we want the Australian government see us as fellow human beings like the community people do. So we got a lot of supporters, and it's been growing. So almost like last week, it's more than 1,000 people down there on Friday and show the solidarity. This is what we really want. So there is a lot of people come to our encampment. And as the result of the encampment in Melbourne, Sydney also doing the encampment. And the Brisbane also joined hands. They're doing the encampment. And Adelaide actually started today. So they, every state, start the encampment of 24/7. So this is a serious issue of the refugees. So as Melbourne, I'm in Melbourne, so we've got a lot of supporters for our encampment in Melbourne. So we need the same support in a different state as well. So if we wanted to stay together, unite together, we will definitely win. So I'm so grateful for the community support. Thank you.
Definitely. And I was about to ask if there's plans for you know, more national encampments, but it sounds like it's already underway. So hopefully we'll see that grow and even see perhaps an encampment over here in Western Australia in Perth. But thank you so much for speaking to us today, Prasanth. Really appreciate you taking the time. And, you know, again, to express we'd like to express our solidarity to you and everyone that's involved in the encampment, and, you know, wish you all the best in your struggles.
No worries. Thank you so much.
That was Prasanth, who is an organizer with the Melbourne Refugee Camp, speaking to me earlier today. And this is the Indie Media Show with Alex, Ray, Darrow, who's always even popped into the studio to say good day.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
You're back with the Indie Media Show here on RTRFM 92.1, the sound alternative. Last Tuesday, the construction division of the CFMU and WA held a rally in coordination with rallies that happened throughout the country, displaying the remaining strength and collective power of the construction union. Tens of thousands of people marched throughout the country in defiance of the laws brought in by the Labor government to bring in an administrator to essentially undermine the democratic structures of the union, threatening their leadership and threatening the very agreements and conditions and safety, all of which has been hard fought by the construction union over many years. And at a critical moment for the trade union movement generally, an absolute pivot point, you know, where it trade unions worth their salt need to come out in defence of the CFMU, and indeed a number of them did last Tuesday, including Steve McCartney from the AMWU. There were members there from the Rail, Bus and Transport Union, and also the Electrical Trades Union. Going to bring you a little bit of a package, some vox pops and some highlights from that rally, including an extract from a speech from the Electrical Trade Union State Secretary Peter Carter.
Hey guys, sorry to interrupt you. My name's Alex Whiston. I'm from RTRFM Community Radio. Sorry if you want to say maybe a few words about what brings you here, the importance of defending unions, you know, given the government's attack on unions. Pretty undemocratic attack on unions, I would have thought, but...
Yeah, and you are correct. Absolutely it is. I mean, they're... That's all politics, mate. I mean, you got your all your construction companies, your builders that are going broke around the country, and they're attacking the workers. I mean, your building industries, what is that, the niche living. Look at the drama they've created to homeowners or home builders. I mean, it's...
Funnily enough, we've actually covered the niche living disaster or debacle on the show, and you're absolutely right. You know, Ronnie Michelle, our Harge Managing Director, he's driving a Merc and building homes for his wife. He's okay. He's not being held accountable. I mean, let's say for argument's sake, there is corruption, criminality in the union. I mean, okay, that's fine, but it doesn't mean you've got to take over the union and abolish it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, how many politicians are perfect? You're not going to take over that. You...
under the carpet with the politicians.
Yeah, absolutely. So important to be here today, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely, mate. Because this is purely politics. Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you for that.
Well, I guess a lot of people are getting tired of being done over by the government. We put them into power and they turn and do this sort of stuff. It's not right. That's why we're here.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thanks, mate. Thank you.
Well, construction workers and workers need a voice, and I think it's unethical, the action that's been taken against the union when the officials are democratically elected and they need to stay for the safety of the workers as well as their salaries.
You're an MUA member, I know, but what brings you here as a union member, given, you know, let's say for argument's sake, there is criminality in the union? Well, so what? That's no excuse to bring in an administrator and attack it and undermine the democratic structure of the union.
That's right. If there is criminality in the union, it's got to be proved to start off with, and it's up to the rank and file to do something about it, not intervention by a right-wing government, because that means the union itself is under threat. And that's the reason I'm here. I'm just disgusted with what the Labor Party has done, and I hope that rallies like this are going to continue on till the CFMEU and the MUA and all our unions are free from restrictions that they continually put on workers.
I was around in the 1980s over East and then in Western Australia in 86, 87 for the deregistration of the BLF, which did nothing to make better conditions in the building industry until the formation of the CFMEU in the early 90s. But I also want to give you a little bit of history of why maybe they didn't want a full inquiry into this. And I go back to 2014, upon the election of the Abbott government, after two terms of an ALP government, who decided that they had to have an investigation, a royal commission, the highest investigation in the land, on the union movements in the construction industry and the MUA. And for 6 to 12 months before that royal commission, we had the media fanning the flames of propaganda to say that the unions were corrupt. Now, in a royal commission, the unions, what we had to do, we had to give the investigators the best the Crown they could offer. Our records, our financial records, going back 7 years. 7 years. And it was forensically audited. And guess what the outcome was? Absolutely nothing. Zilch. Donut. Not one piece of evidence of corruption was on air. In fact, it was the opposite. Every single cent that we collect, all the unions here, ETU, CFMEU, plumbers, AMWU, we had to put our records there, they were forensically audited, and every single cent, the money we collect on behalf of our members and the money we spend on behalf of our members was accounted for. Every single cent. And that's the way it should be. We take the government and administration of our union serious. But what we saw was a political and union pile-up. And I also forward my disgust at the ACTU for throwing the CFMEU out instead of using what they could have used and turn the attention as to why union allegations are treated different to corporate allegations. Where is the call for administration and new laws when the financial industry were proven to collect fees from dead people and massive amounts of money laundering? Or the aged care, the private sector, loads of private sector providers were proven to be treating our aged care in disgraceful ways. Where was the call, the outcry from the media and everyone else for new legislation and for appointed administrators going into their corporations? There was none. So, comrades, it's a pleasure to stand in front of fellow-minded trade unionists who understand why we're being divided. Not just by this federal and state government, but by social media, who are owned by the richest people on earth, who are sending millions and millions of pings into the millions and millions of supercomputers we have. And they're not blaming themselves for hoarding the wealth and the infrastructure and everything else. But in this case, it's the CFMEU's fault. In other cases, it's immigrants' fault. Or refugees. Or that brown fella over there who doesn't look like you, to divide us. We will not be divided. We understand that the working class have got to stand united. And that's what we'll do from today. Thank you, comrades.
CFMEU!
Here for the vote!
CFMEU!
Here for the vote!
Who built this city?
We built this city!
Who built this city?
We built this city!
Who built this city?
We built
Highlights there from the CFMEU rally last Tuesday. Inspiring stuff in defiance of the Federal Labor Government's absolutely disgraceful legislation to take over the union, a precedent that could be of grave harm to many other trade unions and indeed any democratic organisations the government doesn't like, and just come in and appoint administrators now without charge or trial, apparently. You're, of course, listening to the Indie Media Show. It's just gone past 11:30 a.m. with your hosts Ramon Grenfell and Alex Wisson and Zoe, who's just popped out of the studio.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
And this is the Indie Media Show with your hosts Raymond Grenfell and Martin Alexander Wisson. The Land Forces International Defence Exposition is coming to Melbourne from next week. It's the biggest arm fair in the Southern Hemisphere, taking place from September the 11th to the 13th of September at the Melbourne Convention and Exhibition Centre. In response to this, a really broad coalition of groups are getting together to disrupt Land Forces, as they're saying, to protest what is ostensibly an arms fair, a convention for war and death. Some of the largest military contractors in the world are getting together to try and sell their wares. So a bunch of people have gotten together to protest this convention. And a little earlier today, I had the opportunity to speak to Natalie, who's one of the organizers for Disrupt Land Forces. And I started just by asking Natalie, what exactly is the Land Forces International Defence Exposition?
Land Forces is Australia's biggest weapons expo, and it is quite disgusting that it is coming to Melbourne. What that means is that, you know, a weapons expo is where hundreds of people will come from different weapons companies. They will come from, different militaries around the world. We will have people from our own government as well and from our own defence force who will be all sitting together under one roof, making some deals, signing some pretty big contracts, basically to sell weapons of, you know, destruction, weapons that will be used to inflict horrendous pain and suffering as we are witnessing now live on our screens in Gaza. This is basically the place where they meet. The weapons companies showcase their, latest technologies. We will have things like killer robots, lots of, you know, AI sort of surveillance, some very, horrendous new ways of killing people faster and faster and feeding the war machine, profiteering from war, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Gaza there, and one thing I think that comes to mind is that often in these sorts of, wars and occupations around the world, these days governments sort of, you know, toe this line of, well, we're not directly involved, you know, this, and the Albanese government has been sort of quite clear in trying to paint this picture as though somehow they are, you know, these neutral sort of parties that are not involved. And yet, as you're saying there, there are of course many Australian companies that are involved in the manufacturing or supply of weapons that are being used in places like Gaza. Can you speak to that and how it's sort of, there's been this kind of strange abstraction where somehow a government can say, well, we're not exporting arms to Israel, for instance. But then when you actually look into the finer details, well, there are actually a number of companies that are involved in the manufacturing of parts or supplying of parts for arms in conflicts and war.
Yeah, I mean, the PR department of the Australian government and the Victorian government has been, you know, working pretty well. The propaganda that they're spreading, I suppose, on trying to get out of the public's eye, trying to, get out from their responsibility towards international law by saying that there are no weapons being, you know, manufactured and exported to Israel or to, you know, the killing in West Papua and to other places where there are genocides occurring. And that is, you know, completely false. We have, you know, there's publicly available data and information through the defense websites and through a number of freedom of information requests that a lot of organizations have put through that show that Australian companies are indeed manufacturing parts to weapons that are being used to commit these, the murder. Yes, we don't assemble the weapon here, and so we're not exporting, you know, an F-35 jet, but we have companies that are absolutely vital in the supply chain of making the F-35 fighter jet, which actually recently has been sort of marked to be suitable for nuclear weapons as well. And so we're seeing more and more of these jets being manufactured. We saw that in the US, they have just signed a new contract where they're going to be sending, I think, 150 more fighter jets to Israel. And so, the Australia has kind of placed the government has placed our weapons manufacturing industry in a really interesting spot, because in this way, by not actually assembling weapons, they are able to not be held accountable to international law. And so, yeah, as you said, it is completely false. It is spreading spreading propaganda that so that they don't have to be held responsible. Right here, so there's been, I'm in Melbourne at the moment, I'm in Naam. We've had multiple campaigns against specific companies that are really vital in that supply chain of that jet I was speaking of earlier. We've had a campaign recently at a company called Electromold that is maybe half an hour out of the main city. Electromold is one of its kind. And so there is actually one machine inside this facility, and without this machine, the F-35 cannot be assembled. And so, you know, this is what we're seeing over and over again. We have a map on the website that is called, you know, Weapons Manufacturers in Australia. It is publicly available. It's all based on information that has come from government websites that shows all of the different companies that are contributing and exactly how they are contributing. We have Lovett, we have Boeing, Elbit. There's hundreds of companies that are somehow involved. And so, that does not mean that they should not be held to account. Land Forces, again, is a place where they're all going to be coming together. We've had so many campaigns against so many of these companies, and like Talis, a couple of days ago, we had also a bunch of actions there. But Land Forces is a place where they're all going to be meeting together. And we, you know, this is why we have put so much effort into organizing and mobilizing around this expo, is because we're not just going to one company, we're going to 100, and we're not just going and protesting outside of one MP's office or the Parliament House. They're all going to be there anyway, and so it's just a really good space, I suppose, to show that we're not okay with that. Yeah,
it is a good opportunity. I mean, and also, I guess, you know, despite anyone's differing political opinions, really, it should be quite uncontroversial to demonstrate against an expo for the companies that are the manufacturers of war and death.
Yeah.
You'd hope that a lot of people will come down, and perhaps a broad church, so to speak, of people from different backgrounds. I notice you have got a considerable coalition of groups that have come together. Can you talk us through that a little bit? Because often, while these expos, these conventions are horrendous and they shouldn't be existing at all, they also offer an opportunity to perhaps sort of regroup and rebuild movements as well. And there seems to be a broad coalition of people involved. Have you had a lot of support from, I guess, a cross-section of different, social and environmental and economic justice groups that are getting involved in this?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. Probably actually the most fulfilling part of this campaign is the outreach part, and is, you know, the fact that this is something that a lot of your average, you know, Australian would probably be against. And so we, from the beginning, decided that we wanted to prioritise voices of our frontline impacted communities. You know, that means that we want to involve them, but it also means that when we don't want to invite them so that they are, again, taking the front line. We don't want to be endangering people by inviting them to a space that's going to be, you know, not very safe with Victoria Police escalation. And so it's been a really interesting way of, you know, reaching out to like Refugee Action Collective, you know, the African Solidarity Network, the Tamil Refugee, Tamil Refugee Council, and of course, like with our own First Nation mob here, and in different places around the continent as well. I just, you know, like for me, I came here as a refugee from Syria maybe 11 years ago, and I know that refugee communities on this continent are quite afraid of, you know, making their voices heard or saying something that is out of line. A lot of refugees are still waiting for visas, you know, after 12 years, and they, even though they would be absolutely, you know, horrified by the fact that this expo is taking place, we know that most of them won't actually show up because the way that the media portrays this sort of thing is actually quite disgusting. And they only really report when on police brutality. They never really show the community aspect of it, or when we have our weekly peaceful rallies, they just don't care anymore. The media only wants to show, yeah, I suppose, that aspect of it. So, yeah, we've had some really good really good input and collaboration from the cross-section of community. On our website, we have this really nice graphic that shows the logos of, 45 different communities, you know, all the way from, like, student movements, so all of the encampments and the groups that we're organising around that. We also have all of the council area groups. And so, you know, community groups that have been sort of organising around getting motions through their council, and they've come on board and they've mobilised their people as well to join us. We have some different ethnic groups, like lots of people from the South America, from Africa, and obviously all of the people who've been mobilised around the issue of Palestine. A lot of my community, a lot of Syrians, Lebanese, Palestinians, Iraqis. The idea here, like Philippines, and the idea is that we just want to connect people in the global south who have been impacted by war. And I see this as a really important opportunity to build a proper alliance of anti-war organizations, or, you know, community groups that are working to support people who come from war, to maybe just have some strategy conversations about the anti-war movement in Australia and the fact that it really hasn't existed for such a long time. We don't really have structures in place. And so I'm really, really excited, of course, for the mobilization itself, but more so, I think, what's going to come after and how we're going to build on from this to really, really be bridging all these gaps. And of course, working like really strongly, or trying to, with the climate movement as well, because war and climate are very, very related. And as we move further into, climate catastrophe, we're going to see more war and more refugee crises. And I really want to be, kind of connecting the dots and starting to think in broader terms of movement building on the left. And, instead of all of us working separately. It's going to be interesting.
No, definitely. Or perhaps even rebuilding it. I mean, as you mentioned there, I'm old enough to have participated in a lot of the anti-war in Iraq and anti-war in Afghanistan. And sadly, as you mentioned, the anti-war movement here in Australia is not what it once was at all, and hasn't been probably for a good 20 years. You did mention there, I guess, the media coverage of this, and you know, without wanting to sort of to perpetuate any of the stuff that's broadcast on corporate media, there is still this the reality that we are seeing an increasing state repression and demonizing of protesters and demonizing of activism, as we've seen with the treatment of Blockade Australia activists in recent times, and also the crackdown on those demonstrating against the war on Gaza and so forth. For some of us, we went to demonstrations such as APEC in Sydney, where there was an absolutely insane, draconian sort of state crackdown on dissent there. And even some of our listeners will probably remember demonstrations such as S11 in Melbourne and the aftermath of that. Is there signs of, I guess, police repression and, or signs of that the state is really sort of preparing to crack down on people? And I guess, it's difficult to, we don't want to overstate it to some extent, as you're saying there, but it's also, there is a reality of that increasing, demonization and police repression. And, and I guess how can people sort of deal with that and still be effective in their action and in their direct action?
Yeah, there absolutely are signs. I would say it's more than just signs. They have explicitly stated to the media about a week and a half ago that they will be mobilising 1,800 police officers from the regions, specifically for land forces, which is equivalent to about a tenth of the force in the entire state. That is a massive number, and that is going to cost millions of dollars. And so they have come out already to try and control the narrative. They even showed footage of the World Economic Forum protest that happened in Melbourne. That was in the year 2000, I believe. And the footage was mostly of police brutality and violence and aggression. And, in the way that the media was reporting on it, they basically said, this is the World Economic Forum and this is going to be basically exactly the same, but probably even bigger. And so the police are very clear in that they're going to be largely mobilizing to stop people from protesting. We know that they will probably have increased police powers during that time at that location. So we've seen that happen at another conference, at the ASEAN conference a few months ago, which was at the same location. Under these increased power laws, they can stop and search anyone. They can confiscate anything that is on your body. They can ask for ID, and if you don't show ID, then they can arrest you until ID is proven. Basically, it's just it enables them to control crowds and control a situation in a much larger way, I suppose. And so we do expect that does not stop us from exercising our right to protest. What we are doing is completely legal, and it is our moral duty and responsibility to be, taking a stand against something as disgusting as this conference coming to the city. But we have a lot of structures in place that will hopefully, support people if they are impacted by this. We've seen police repression increase gradually over the past year or so. We are quite well-versed with the tactics that police have been using in Victoria. We are seeing that they're starting to really, have a crack at the Sunday rally, for example. For about 6 months, the Sunday rally just ran peacefully every week, and police, kind of stood back and let it happen. Now we're seeing that they are trying to break the lines of the protesters. They confiscate the speakers, so the audio equipment. So they've been pushing a lot more. And we've also seen them use excessive force at pickets, lots of violent arrests. Basically, we have pepper spray every time we have a picket now. And it's kind of just become the new norm. And that speaks volumes to maybe some anti-protest laws that are going to come into play soon, because we're seeing really big escalations. And so on the one hand, we want to be pushing back, but on the other as well, like, we don't want anti-protest laws to come into place because that will make everything so much more difficult. Now, in terms of, like, structures that we have, there is a lot of upskilling that is happening ahead of time. Basically, every second or third day, we have legal training, so for people to know their rights. We have police liaison training. We have, like, tactical training on how to move when police are, escalating. We have a team of marshals that's going to be there on the day that will be helping people, kind of vacate if necessary. We have really good groups of medics that will be there at all times to support people. We have legal observers that will be dressed in a pink jacket and that will be taking evidence of everything that's going on or as much as they can. And we have a care team that's sort of like a activist care team. We basically look after people during and after, especially if people are arrested or taken to the watch house, and we'll make sure that we pick them up and things like food and walking your pet as much as we can, of course. And so we've done everything that we can to ensure that there is support for people. And there are also spaces where attendees don't have to interact with police at all. There are events that are happening that are completely off-site. We have a vigil that is in a different place. We've got like a speak out where people from war background are going to come and talk about the effect of war and militarism on their countries and their lands. And so there's a variety of ways that people can partake in these protests. Yeah.
Awesome. And yeah, I guess just finally on that, obviously, a lot of these demonstrations, understandably, actions need to be organized securely and, but it sounds like there's a lot of things that people can just attend. For anyone that may be already heading over there for this, I mean, obviously we're on the other side of the country, yeah. So I don't know how many people from WA are going to be getting over there, but, you never know, one of our listeners just happens to be over there next week. What's the best way people can kind of find out what's happening and potentially get involved in disrupting land forces?
It's on Instagram mostly and the website. And I believe we are also on Facebook, which I know a lot of people don't really use anymore. But yeah, on Instagram is Disrupt Land Forces or Disrupt Wars. There's two accounts we'll basically share across those two. There's also disruptlandforces.org. Our website has all of the information that you need. There is a page with all of the events, and it also includes the training. There's also a way to sign up to be involved on the website. And once you sign up, then we'll give you a call or send you an email to join a group chat on Telegram, which is a little bit more secure. It's been really interesting to organize a mobilization publicly when we know there's also going to be other things that happen where we don't know about them. And so at this stage, it's like we're inviting people to the public events, especially our first event, so opening the mobilization with a truth-telling circle with Uncle Robbie Thorpe at Camp Sovereignty here in Nam. And that's going to be happening on the Sunday. To be honest, attending that first event is probably going to be the easiest way to get involved, because we will all just be there and we can let people know what's going on. So it's pretty easy to find us online. Otherwise, Camp Sovereignty on Sunday.
That was Natalie from the Disrupt Land Forces Convergence. That's kicking off this Sunday in Nam, Melbourne. If you're interested in that, maybe you can get over there. Maybe you're going to be in Melbourne next week and you can get down and participate. But I'm sure we will keep you updated as to how things unfold over there. That's pretty much it for the radio show this week, Marty.
Indeed, it's been fun as always. Thanks to our guests and thanks to the fine men and women of the CFMU for rallying last Tuesday. There'll be more to come. And that story, they did say that's not the last rally. So big fight ahead, I think, for anyone who cares about militant democratic trade unions in this country.
We'll be back next week, of course, at 11 a.m. But keep it locked, though. After the news with Michaela, Rhiann Todhunter is going to be taking you out to lunch. All your new music needs for the week. Please do get in touch if you've got an idea for a story, or hit us up on our corporate social media, or email us at RTR. But yeah, we'll be back next week at 11 a.m. And as we say every week, though,
don't hate the media.
Become the media.
See you next week.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.